Join us.
Tune in on Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
Hi, I'm B.B. King, you know, the guy that plays that guitar called Lucille, and when I'm in Portland, I get my blues from KBOO. That's 90.7 FM on your radio. Please stay tuned. They might play one of my records.
You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman speaks to novelist Catherine Lacey about her new book, Certain American States, a collection of stories about ordinary people seeking and failing to find the extraordinary in their lives. This KBOO program is made possible by KBOO listener member support and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts presenting Punch Brothers and Andrew Bird Saturday, August 18th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater starting at 7 p.m. Doors open at 5 p.m. and all ages welcome. Tickets and more information online at zooconcerts.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Catherine Lacey. Lacey's debut novel, Nobody Is Ever Missing, was a finalist for the New York Public Library's Young Lions Fiction Award, a New Yorker Best Book of the Year, and heralded by Time Out New York as the hands-down best book of 2014. Her follow-up novel, The Answers, received starred reviews from both Kirkus and Publishers Weekly, was called one of the most ingenious books of the year by the Wall Street Journal, named a top 10 book of 2017 by the New York Times, and prompted Lauren Groff to call Lacey one of the most intelligent and funny writers of her generation. In addition, Catherine Lacey is also the co-author with Forsyth Harmon of the nonfiction book The Art of the Affair, an illustrated history of love, sex, and artistic influence, a book Elle magazine called A Dose of Naughtily Narrated A-List Gossip from Colette to Ellington, Kahlo to Mapplethorpe. Named one of Granta's best young American novelists, Catherine Lacey is a Whiting Award winner and the John Grisham Writer in Residence at the University of Mississippi. She's here today on Between the Covers to talk about her first book of stories, Certain American States, just out from FSG. Publishers Weekly says of Certain American States that these are stories of modern complexity and nearly Dickensian emotional heft. Kirkus calls the collection wryly devastating, a fully realized vision. Colin Barrett adds that with spare but poetically concentrated style, Catherine Lacey vividly captures the addled, bombed out, wryly fuzzy perspectives of her lost and drifting characters. These are stories of mystery and brooding, wintry beauty. Enjoy Press at the Los Angeles Times says of Lacey's writing, Lacey captures with eerie precision the strangeness of being a person in the world, living alongside other human beings with unknowable thoughts and feelings. Reading Lacey's fiction feels like walking through a dark apartment in someone's mind, full of winding hallways and unmarked doors. You never know quite where you are or where you'll end up. Like the work of Clarice Lispector or Rachel Cusk, Lacey seems to be on the verge of inventing a new genre somewhere between prose poem and fugue state. Welcome to Between the Covers, Catherine Lacey.
Thanks for having me.
So, given that this is your first collection of stories, I do want to hear about the experience of the difference between writing stories for you and writing novels. But I wanted to start with the similarities because I see a lot of crossover and things. In all three books, it feels like there's a strong sense of voice, of being swept forward by a rush of thoughts of our protagonist. And more often than not, because your prose is so voice-driven, the story is often told in first person.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to hear your thoughts about this. how much you see these as choices versus sort of a place you automatically start and why.
Yeah, I feel like both with the novels and with every single story, when they work, I mean, there's many failed stories that are not in the collection. There's many, you know, I thought I was writing a novel and charged 50 pages in only to realize that, like, there was something missing. When it's working, I do feel like I'm just being swept up by some sense of a voice. I think it almost feels like I have a memory somehow that of something that didn't happen, and I'm trying to figure it out. Or like that state when you just wake up and you just had a dream and you don't want to forget it, and so you're just you're like concentrating on it and you're trying to like piece out like each little element of it. When it really is working, it does feel like that. And I find that now, it used to be that I would just, like, for years I just woke up every morning and would write for as many hours as I could until I had to go to some place to earn money or like do something else. And those years I feel like I was working, like it was, you know, trying to just exercise out some sentences and just like follow a character until it didn't make sense anymore. And there was a kind of like drudgery to it. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like the longer I've gone on, the more I can sort of recognize when I have a voice versus when I'm like flailing around or just playing or something like that. And there's room for plenty of play, I feel like, in one's work as well. But to be able to recognize when you're actively working with a real character or when you're just kind of just writing, you know, versus like being carried away by something that could be useful to someone else. There's a life in it that's not yours.
Well, you've cited the philosophy and techniques of a French acting teacher and mime, Jacques Lecoq.
Yes.
On your own writing. So this, him being, his techniques having an influence on your writing. And I was hoping you could speak to his approach to performance and the way it influences you, whether they're theories or techniques, and particularly if they influence your enactment of voice.
Yeah, so I'm certainly no expert on Jacques Lecoq or his whole like mime school, but there were a few years ago I read a book by him that now I can't remember the title of, but and it went over a couple of different exercises that he would have in his school in France where various mimes studied and clowns. One of which would be he would have a student put a mask on that would be like this kind of blank mask. And they had to convey character through their body entirely. And so, you know, every little gesture, if you don't have your face, you know, your face is your most expressive thing. So when you remove that, you see how deeply expressive your body can be. And when I was reading about that, I was thinking about the formation of, when I hit like kind of the nerve of writing Nobody Is Ever Missing, before it was Nobody Is Ever Missing, it was just some stories. But at one point I finally like hit this nerve and this like character sort of revealed herself, and there was like a physical posture to her, and there was like a kind of a way in which I held my body while I was writing that character. And she did just feel like it was a physical state that came with this sort of, you know, because a character's not a real person, it's just a matrix of ideas and memories and images, and we're just sort of plowing through it trying to sort of untangle what is this thing, what is this feeling. So in order for it to be more real to me while I was writing it and other characters since then, I found that I have to find the way that the character manifests in my body first. So he has some other techniques that are interesting too, but that's the only one that I can really speak to.
And when you say you were assuming this posture, you mm-hmm. were assuming this posture of your character as a technique,
yeah.
as a and in the hope
like
that
literally at the laptop, it kind of, I realized at some point that while I was writing her, once that character was really going and I could just plug into her voice, that I would be kind of, there was a certain sort of tension like in my shoulders, and like it's almost like there was a part, like my belly button was like trying to touch my spine or something. And it was this kind of like bracing sort of posture. And when I was, when I was writing her, I would go into that posture, or I would go into that posture so I could write her. So it became this sort of symbiotic relationship between the two.
Yeah. Well, Jacques Lecoq has this quote, "The body knows things of which the mind is ignorant."
Exactly.
And it's kind of fascinating to imagine that maybe you assume this different posture and then different language results because of the posture you're assuming. But I also wondered, there's something mysterious to me about your writing in the sense that there's a way in which I feel like we're going thought to thought in many of these stories and also in the novels. And yet it doesn't feel like stream of consciousness in the sense I don't feel like we're trapped in a head.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow I feel like you create this union between a stream of consciousness sensation and being out in space in the world as well as being in a body. And I don't know if it's because of these techniques or otherwise, but I'd love to hear about it because I feel like every time I wonder what is the next thought going to be? And yet also the next thought seems to change the plot instead of just being a thought. It's not like Proust thinking about the past.
Right.
It's moving the plot forward in a different way. Do you recognize that?
It does make sense. I think maybe if there's, I mean, I think any strong choice you make in a work of fiction or in life comes with, you know, no matter how positive or useful that choice is, it also comes with an underside. And so I think following this sort of stream of consciousness, sort of anxious narrator or whatever in Nobody's Ever Missing, the flip side to it was that sometimes I do think that the hazard of that book is that you do kind of get locked into her head. Mm. There is a usefulness to it, and there's also kind of a discomfort to it. I mean, I'm fine with like making readers uncomfortable, but that was kind of the hazard that I saw. And I think since then I maybe modulate that a little bit more. At the same time, like, I think that, you know, the things that we think do, it does create the space around us. I mean, not like in a you know, the ants, what's that book that that people were like thinking, like all this magical thinking of like you can just manifest whatever you want.
Oh, it's The Secret.
The Secret. Yeah. Not in that kind of way. Like, you can't just think anything you want and manifest it. But I do think that the thoughts that we have affect our posture and affect our relationships to other people and that in the immediate space with us. And it does change our reality, like, yeah, as we go, you know.
But it definitely doesn't feel like your books are a disembodied brain. Like, sometimes you'll read writing that feels right. Like it's just a mind.
It's all head. Yeah. Like, it's like they've, yeah, it's like the narrator has no sensation in their body whatsoever, and they're only processing things intellectually.
Yeah.
That's a posture to take, and I wonder if some people actually just feel that way. I feel very much, like, aware of the various fluctuations of my body, like, for better or worse, and it does affect, you know. I mean, maybe this is actually, it might, I'm going to put a theory out there. It's sort of untested. Although, did you have Sheila Hady on here today?
Yeah.
That's right. I think she was talking about this in the interview with you, where, like, a woman's relationship to her body, it necessarily has this narrative, this, like, repeating narrative. And I wonder if, like, fiction, I'm just talking off my face right now, but I wonder if fiction by women has, the narrators are often more aware of the intricacies of their physical experience, and not just the intricacies of their intellectual experience of the world. Yeah. I wonder if there's,
wonder,
like,
too.
Yeah, that would be, maybe there's a PhD student out there that's listening.
Well, hopefully they'll write in.
Yeah, let me know.
So another one of the themes that I feel like unites the stories in certain American states and between those stories and your books is what seems like a deep interest in the life cycles of love or romantic mm-hmm. relationships. So whether it be a story that's set in the wake of a relationship's breakup or a story that's on the verge of falling apart because one of the characters suddenly adopts a new trajectory, mm-hmm. And how are they going to cope? It feels like the calculus of love, what it means to stay together or to fall apart, seems to be in the forefront of a lot of your writing.
Yeah.
And I wondered if that, how that sounded to you, and if you had any, you know, self-reflective theories on why you return to this material in specific.
Well, I think there's a couple things to it. I mean, one, I think it's just something that's a lifelong interesting thing to human beings. Like, we want, everybody needs some sort of, like, love in their life or friendship or companionship. And I do think that the kind of the theater of the relationship is, it's just an interesting stage. It's just ripe with conflict, and it's ripe with the kind of conflict that I'm interested in, which is, you know, it, two people have to sort of negotiate their past with each other, and they have to negotiate their bodies with each other, and then also just domestic space often. So that's just the stage that I'm interested in. That said, these three books were written somewhat close together and pretty much all in my like late 20s, like into my early 30s. And I think that time especially, you're really trying to figure out, you're trying to figure out yourself in relation to other people, or what do you want to do with kind of a, whether you want to have a partner or not, or what sort of partner are you? So I think there's maybe more of a concern, although, you know, I immediately want to argue with myself. I was about to say that there's more of a concern with relationship here than like things that I've been working on since. And I think that's a lie. There is another book that's coming up that has almost nothing weirdly to do with romantic relationships, like now that I'm thinking of it. And then some other work that I've been doing feels farther away from it. But I doubt that I'm sure that there's a book in the future in which I will grapple with that again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even when your stories aren't depicting the aftermath of love or the imminent falling apart, it feels like you're dramatizing moments of transition. Mm-hmm. That are similarly charged. Mm-hmm. So it could be the death of a family member, for instance.
Right.
But moments when everything changes and everything needs to be reconsidered. And you've quoted Auden before, a quote about great art. Great art is clear thinking about mixed feelings. And it made me wonder about mixed feelings in relation to moments where we are no longer able to continue on the path that we have momentum on. So we have this thing we're doing, mm-hmm. With another person, and, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden everything we presumed was going to continue off into the horizon is needing to be changed. Can you talk a little bit about mixed feelings, which don't feel like the obvious place to go for dramatization? These points of transition and pivot do, but this dramatization of mixed feelings seems maybe more challenging.
Right, because do you think it sounds more challenging because you're not coming down with like a clear statement all the time?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you'll have these often women characters in your book who either have past relationships or soon to be past relationships, mm-hmm. that are sort of casting their shadow forward across the action that occurs. Mm-hmm. And so there's I guess there is a lot of action, mm-hmm. in one respect, but there's also a lot of rumination happening in your pieces.
I guess I like characters that aren't even clear to me, you know, because I don't like finishing a story and feeling like, oh, I know that character now. I think that would just be an illusion. I think in the same way that like when somebody breaks up with you, or when you realize you need to leave someone, or like that something that you thought was true, whether it's a relationship or a worldview or something, when that falls apart, there's something more substantial revealed about all individuals involved in that transition. And those places are just, I don't know why, to me they seem like the most logical places to write from. I don't know, it's funny how like somebody points something out that you're doing in your work and you didn't even realize that it was a choice, nor did you think that it was unusual in any way. But I do see what you're saying, that I guess it is an unusual place to...
Well, when you say, like when Auden says great art is clear thinking, yeah. about mixed feelings,
and, yeah.
but yet you say you don't necessarily want to be clear about the characters that you're dramatizing.
Right.
They're not clear.
Right.
And maybe you also aren't clear, it sounds like.
Well, they don't need to be clear. I mean, I feel like the sentences need to be clear. And that's important to me. The images need to be clear, but if the characters are clear, then there's no story. Like,
right.
if there's nothing moving within that character that's murky and sort of scary, then there's no story. So
maybe that is the obvious,
yeah.
that the mixed
right.
feelings is the place for all great art. Ultimately.
Right, that's yeah. how I feel anyway.
Yeah. Well, you once wrote an essay about your love of the Cy Twombly gallery.
I love him so much.
And I want to read a small part of it and pair it with something that Jacques Lecoq said, and then ask you your thoughts.
Okay.
So you once wrote, "If one accepts that love is at least one part disaster, if one accepts that love cannot be effectively diagnosed or measured, if one accepts that a person cannot predict or control when such a feeling might take root, if one accepts that a person in love frequently behaves in a manner that others see as irrational, and if one accepts that it is difficult, if not altogether impossible, to explain those feelings, then it may be possible for a woman of 22 to be in love, however briefly, with an entire building and all of its contents. I love that.
Thank you.
And then Jacques Lecoq once said, error is not just acceptable, it is necessary for the continuation of life, provided it is not too great. A large error is a catastrophe, a small error is essential for enhancing existence. Without error, there is no movement. Death follows. So while neither you nor him were talking about writing in these quotes, I feel if we were to pair these two ideas together, this idea about love is one part disaster and this idea that error is essential for enhancing existence, I would put that forth as sort of an Ars Poetica of Catherine Lacey.
Oh.
I don't know if you feel that way, that your characters are exploring and perhaps you're exploring this through them, and that you're allowing, like, not only just that you're allowing error and disastrous love, but that somehow that is all, like, essential to them exploring.
Yeah, I do feel like, yeah, disaster and error and mistakes of all variety are absolutely 100% necessary to progressing as a human being, and therefore progressing as an artist, and being able to create anything that's useful to anybody else means that you will be destroyed in some part while you're doing it, or by the end of it you had to build up some identity or some framework of viewing the world, and you have to destroy it. And I think that's you know, like, when I recognize that that's what another artist or writer is doing, as I recognize in Cy Twombly's work, that there was something, his work was really a side effect of his project as a human being on this planet to experience messiness and accident and pain and beauty and all those things simultaneously. I become truly, like, haunted in this, in the way that I was haunted by Cy Twombly while he was still alive first, and then now I feel like I speak to his ghost. Like, I feel very, very close to his work, and I think it's because of this thing. It's because he spent his life, and I don't know that much actually about his life, just from the side effect of his work, and, you know, there's a biography supposedly coming up out about him that sounds really good, but I do think that he spent his life pursuing a truth at his own peril, and so that kind of work really inspires me. And I do think that it's not only, like, your project as an artist, but it should just be all people's project as human beings to be willing to receive pain through these accidents and through these disasters in order to progress to, you know, newer and newer states of, I guess, consciousness, although that sounds really, like, a little bit, that's not quite the right word, but I'll leave it there, consciousness.
Okay. In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Catherine Lacey about her new short story collection, Certain American States. We'll just sort of continue along this idea of error enhancing existence and love as one part disaster. Mm-hmm. And you've said before that you think one of the biggest threats or hurdles to writing fiction is thinking you know what you're doing, thinking you are in control. And you quoted Will Eno, a Will Eno play, that says, if we could control life, it wouldn't be life. If we could control our likeness of it, it wouldn't be a likeness. Your characters are often losing control of their lives. And I know you've questioned the writing adage that characters need to have agency. And I would love to hear a little bit about that in relationship to this idea of control. Can you talk about agency in the development of character? And also how it relates to your process of writing characters that may not have it?
Sure. I studied creative nonfiction in graduate school, so I never had, like, those traditional fiction seminars or workshops where you get the, you know, like, the sort of standard definitions of what fiction really needs and how it works. I was, like, pretty distanced from that, although I was very close with some people that were in the fiction program. And so I remember at some point hearing from one of them, like, oh yeah, like, all fiction, like, every character needs agency, or, like, every, like, a you know, an important character will have agency and they'll do something. And I thought that was ridiculous because there's just an enormous amount of people on this planet that don't have agency necessarily about at least, you know, some crucial or, you know, extremely crucial parts of their lives. So I wouldn't want to, you know, think that we can't write fiction about those characters because they don't have control of their lives enough. So I do think that it's something to argue with. At the same time, it can be really boring to read a book that focuses on a person who can't do anything, and so they're completely stuck in their head. Because I do think that there's actions that we can take, whether or not they're the ones we want to take. So,
and what about you as a writer? When you say one of the biggest threats to writing fiction mm-hmm. is thinking you have control, what is that? Can you unpack that a little bit? What does that mean in regards to writing these stories?
Yeah, I guess I should say for me, like I think, and because there are those sorts of writers that like to plan everything out and then enter into the plan and like produce the thing. I'm not sure I like any of the work of people that do things that way. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I certainly for me, I feel that when I feel like I have too clear of a plan, or I know exactly where something is going, or I can describe it in full before it's done, then a lot of the energy gets drained out for me. And also I will miss all the, you know, exciting accidents that can happen along the way.
What reminds me of one of the quotes in the intro about your work being like walking in a dark apartment.
Yeah.
Because I feel like what you're describing is what you're also enacting at the same time. Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it feels like walking in a dark apartment for you, but you needing yes. to have this, the horizon to be dark and the sense of discovery as you move forward.
Yeah.
And that's definitely how it feels following your characters somehow at the same time, which maybe is, I mean, maybe this comes back to this mystery around the connection of embodiment.
Well, yeah, I do think that the book or a story is really the product of a performance, which is somebody was thinking about these ideas and they put these ideas into these characters in this situation, and they when you're in the state of writing something, I really do think you should be the emotional engagement that you have at that moment, I think, does transfer. And I think in revision, we can kind of, you know, it's about moving the lights around and sort of refocusing like tiny things. But really, that initial production of the text is a performance, and the book is the document of that performance you can give to someone else. And the feeling that you have physically and emotionally, I think, will transfer. So.
And what about syntax in relationship to that? I think of your conversation with Renata Adler when you yeah. interviewed her.
Yeah.
Which is so cool that you interviewed her.
I know, it's the funnest thing.
But just her run-on sentences and lots of commas and that sense of that rushing forward.
What really made sense when I interviewed her, because, I mean, when we got the transcript of it, they were Renata Adler sentences that she was saying. Sometimes, you know, sometimes they were spot on and sometimes they fell apart, and, you know, in revision she would have probably put them back together or something. Hmm. So it was interesting to see. I mean, I think your syntax is... it's partially a product of it's partially a product of emotion, I feel, and then it's partially a product of all the books that you've read. So the books that you put into your head, they become the sort of, you know, the ingredients that you have to work with when you're, and not just books, but I think film, music, all the like media that you're consuming, and even the conversations you're having, they all create the vocabulary that you're going to then spew out through your hands, and then the emotions that you're feeling really create the syntax. At this point, I feel like when I'm in true control of a character, and it's not actively controlling the character, but when like the character and I are sort of synced up and things are happening, the sentences that I write, I don't really have to edit so much anymore. Mm. I mean, I think when I was a younger writer, there would be a lot more of like going back together and polishing and taking things out. And now it doesn't, I don't have to do it quite as much. I still do it, but
yeah,
it becomes a little bit more automatic.
Well, let's have you read a little bit for people. Would you read The Healing Center for
us? Absolutely. Sylvia put her hands on her belly, and she put her hands on her hips, and she faced the mirror, and she turned sideways to the mirror, and she faced it again. I lowered my hands from my chest and put them on my hips too, and looked into the mirror at the opposite of Sylvia and at the opposite of me, at all the flesh and hair and shapes we were living in. "Why do we look like this?" Sylvia asked. So I asked Sylvia, "Why do we look like what?" And Sylvia said, "Like women? Why are we women?" I looked at Sylvia's body in the mirror, and I looked at my body in the mirror, and I remembered that my skin is the color that pantyhose companies mean when they say nude, and Sylvia's skin is not that color. Sylvia is an ample woman, and she is the right kind of ampleness, by which I mean she has been strategically engineered by God or whatever to cause earth-shaking want in people, the kind of want that leads people to stay up all night, hostage. "I don't know," Sylvia said. "Never mind." Sylvia was doing a lot of never-minding back then, so much never-minding that it became unclear if she minded anything at all anymore, or if she minded her own mind, or even my mind, or anything that was mine. She'd spent the week cutting her bangs slanted and balancing grapes on her belly button, letting pots of porridge cook to soot on the stovetop. "That's okay," I told her, as the apartment filled with smoke. "People become forgetful when they are happy or worried or thinking about the airplanes of soon, and all you need to do is tell me which one you're doing." I already knew the answer, but back then I was the kind of person who sometimes asked people to say aloud what I already knew. It was obvious that Sylvia was thinking about the airplanes of soon, and which one she'd be on, and where it would go, and what she might do when she got there. I knew she'd do this from the first day she moved in, so it is true that I let myself break myself, or maybe, rather, I let herself let myself break myself, and by self I mean heart, except I take issue with using that word that way, because I don't think we have any reason to pile such a responsibility on that organ, the word of that organ. Everyone knows a heart is just responsible for filling a thing with blood, except it never fills love with blood, because no one can do that, because love comes when it wants, and it leaves when it wants, and it gets on an airplane, and it goes wherever it wants, and no one can ever ask love not to do that, because it is part of the risk of love, the worthwhile risk of it, that it will leave when it feels like leaving, and that is the cost of it, and it is worth it, worth it, worth it. This is the mantra of Sylvia, and this is the way that she is. Sylvia found me at my own never mind moment, back when the acupuncturist was the only person who would listen to me anymore. Doctors 1, 2, 3 all said I was bluffing. Doctor 4 said nothing, left me cold-toed in my paper gown. The acupuncturist wanted me to talk about my mother. How did I feel about her? Did she sing to me when I was a child? Sylvia was the receptionist for the acupuncturist, but all she did was point to a sheet of paper that said, "Sign me." And I would come in, and she wouldn't look at me, until one day she did look at me, and when she looked at me, I also looked at me, and I also looked at her, and she also looked at herself, and we both found we liked what we were looking at. And so we found ourselves months later, waking up at the same place all the time, going to sleep in the same place all the time, walking around link arm to the acupuncturist, the healing center. But one day in my living room, Sylvia stirred her teacup, but there wasn't anything in it, so it just went clank, clank. And then I knew, for some reason, we weren't going around link-armed anymore. "Do you ever get the feeling," Sylvia asked, "that you're a lab rat?" "That I'm a lab rat? That I'm a lab rat, or that you're a lab rat? Which of us?" Sylvia didn't say anything for a minute, kept stirring no tea in her teacup. "Who is the lab rat?" "Who indeed," she said. And I said, "F*** you, Sylvia. This isn't a fairy tale, Sylvia. You can't just say stupid things like that to real people." "I'll say it." "You won't," I said. But she said, "I will. Just watch me."
We've been listening to Catherine Lacey read from Certain American States. You've said that for years you've been trying and failing to develop a syllabus for a class about writing about love.
Mm-hmm.
That the subject of love for writers is a minefield of sentimentality and cliche, and that you wanted to focus on those hazards and possible solutions, but that the syllabus remains unfinished because of either books not making it or not enough books making it onto the syllabus that sort of unpack the feeling of love the way you'd want to mm-hmm. in the class. So I would love to hear what, if any, books are on this syllabus in progress and why, and maybe books that have almost made it or books that types of books that completely exasperate you, because it seems like this must be an open question if you've been thinking about wanting to teach this material and the way it often falls on its face.
You know, in that piece, I think I'd named some of the books, but now I honestly just can't think of any off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Do we want to just like pull it up? And like, I feel like there were some in there.
You did mention Swan's Way.
Yeah, I had just been reading that at that time. I think there is something about that book in particular that overtakes you, that it overtakes you with sentimentality, really. And I mean that in the best way. It's just my problem with sentimentality is that it's a tightrope, and so it's so easy to fall off of it into something else. I think when we look back on, I mean, when we're really moved by something and it's almost too much to bear and you're just sort of like glittering with feeling about it, there's a way in which that excludes a reader or excludes somebody who's not having that feeling, in the same way that like being on a drug sort of excludes people from the reality that you're experiencing and your like hallucinations of whatever. And so that's the risk of sentimentality, or the risk of writing about love, especially because it doesn't make sense to people that are outside of it. And so the project of writing, especially a novel, I don't feel satisfied. Even Swan's Way, I mean, it's a beautiful book. It's, you know, it's gorgeous, and in some way, it still fails to really convey that thing.
Well, if we put aside other books and think about this more on a craft level, which I'm presuming it's an open question for you how best to write about love, and mm-hmm. I'm also presuming that you've probably seen a lot of bad ways it's been written about in just working with students who are trying to. But I also wonder, like, is your attraction towards writing about the aftermath of love or love falling apart sort of an preemptive inoculation against cliche and sentimentality, or if it comes from like a philosophical place, like Tolstoy saying all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think you often write about something by writing about the opposite of it, and so sometimes the best way to write about the potency of the experience of being in love with someone is by writing about what happens when that's removed, because you see. You know, the wound matches the object that used to be in that place. And so, you know, places of total exasperation and exhaustion, they by creating them vividly enough, you can kind of, you know what's missing by its inverse, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about the book you co-created.
Yeah.
The Art of the Affair, An Illustrated History of Love, Sex, and Artistic Influence. So it's sort of another mode in which you raise this question of love, but mm-hmm. here it's not in the writing, but between writers. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering at first if there were any writer liaisons that were of particularly close to you that you wanted to share any details about from there.
Well, the book really began out of Anaïs Nin and Henry Miller. Their relationship, I mean, I feel like their letters to each other are some of the best letters. And I think that in some ways, like, the documents that they left behind about their very strange and, like, lifelong relationship, I think it does kind of capture, like, that the feeling that was between them. And so they were really the impetus for it. Part of the book came out of this just question that I had about, well, if all of... It seemed to me that a lot of books grew out of relationships and grew out of different times in these writers' lives, and I was kind of thinking about, well, I was thinking about wanting to measure a writer's output over time in relationship to the relationships that were in their life, and to what affected these different relationships that they had affect their work, but not just writers, but artists and musicians, and mm-hmm. I mean, I found just an enormous. I mean, one of the best was Miles Davis's Blue Period came out of a really devastating breakup that he had with Juliette Gréco, who is the mm-hmm. musician and actress, French musician and actress. When he went to Paris, he met her. They fell in love. In Paris, they could have a relationship, and they did, and it wasn't a problem. But then he moved back to New York. She came to visit. And it was hell for them. And they were both so sad to end that relationship, but they were just like, you know what, this is, it's impossible. Mm. I mean, I get chills just thinking of it right now, reading about it. And that's where the blue period came from. That's what, I mean, kind of blue, and his blue period and his heroin use and his, like, it really sent him, I mean, I think it's kind of difficult to look at that music now without feeling that, that loss of that love in it. It made so much sense to me when I found that out. So,
and you mentioned in the Arthur Miller on Ace Nin that in the case of Arthur Miller, he wouldn't have had a career without her.
Yeah.
That she paid to have his first novel published. And you also imagine that their relationship had a big impact on the content of each other's work. But, so I wouldn't normally ask this question of you because you're in a partnership with another writer, but
yeah.
Because this is an open question in both your work, just around this interrogation of love, but also in this nonfiction book of the ways in which, like, love between writers can influence each other. Have you? I imagine you've tracked the ways you and Jesse Ball have influenced each other, if at all, or not influenced each other. And I just wanted to throw that your way and see what you thought.
Well, I guess I can't speak to how I've influenced him so much as, and I don't think that it's important that he's a writer so much that he's a person who's engaged with this world in a really interesting way to me. And so it's not like we're trading manuscripts and, like, you know, really, I don't think we're really having any effect on each other's, like, actual work, but...
So you're not literally editing each other?
No, never. I wouldn't dream of it. Yeah. I mean, I think any relationship, I think, changes the way you think. And so inevitably will change what you write about. It's sort of hard to say what, because I don't know, like, you know, I don't know what I would have been doing if I hadn't met him.
Well, hands down, the most unnerving thing that I think writers who listen to the show have heard is Jesse describing his writing process.
Yeah.
Writing some of his novels in a couple weeks. And there's this really great conversation between the two of you where you say that one of the first things you ever said to him was, "I've heard about your methods and I find them suspicious." And you go on to say that you thought that the way he worked was absurd and that it was a lie. And I suspect if you're still with him, since
right.
he's out in the lobby right now, that you've come to a different impression of the process. But I can't imagine that process not being something that would be provocative in some way about being in a relationship with someone who has it, since it's so, I guess, off the bell curve.
Right. It is, I mean, among other things about Jesse that are way off the bell curve.
Yeah.
But... I'm not interested in writing that way, you know? And I did, that was maybe one of the first things I ever said to him, was that I didn't believe that he actually worked that way. I've since, it has been confirmed, he actually works that way. What was the question now?
Well, I mean, it was just that you must have a different impression of his process now that you're with him, but also that just being with someone who has such a extremely different process on the spectrum of writers, that I wonder if that must
reimagine my own process in some ways. Yeah. You know, I think that was probably true at the beginning. Like I was kind of, you know, in the way that you want to be constantly re-engaging with your work and questioning your methods and wondering if they're the correct methods for you. I think there was a period at the beginning where I thought, like, what am I doing when I sit down every morning? Like, what am I doing? And I think since I did kind of set myself a challenge of, like, trying to write very quickly, because I have, you know, I'm a laborer and I will move things around and piddle a good deal in between stuff. So I did wonder what was the point of that. But I've just, you know, I enjoy it. So, like, I like writing every day. And he doesn't have to and he doesn't want to. And so that's how he does things. But
right.
I actually, it just makes sense for me. It's like my thing I do every day. So it was good to realize that again.
Yeah. Well, another area where I feel like you two are kindred spirits is the way in which you both are questioning sort of received writing pedagogy. I'm
mm-hmm.
not saying you're questioning it in the same way, but
mm-hmm.
I think you both are questioning it. And one of the things that you actively have asked is there a different way to teach writing?
Yeah.
And you both seem to reach outside of writing for sources of inspiration. Mm-hmm. I think of your story Learning in this collection, mm-hmm. which I love, which is about a person teaching an elective to soon-to-be lawyers about yeah. watercolor painting. And in the story, it's absurd. The students question the value of it, but it also feels like it's maybe pointing to something that you're getting at around pedagogy. When I think of Jacques Lecoq, and also this interview you did in the Creative Independent, which it ends with these recommendations that are not presented as pedagogy for students, but I sort of imagine them in a Lacey taught writing class. I don't know if it's true, but you said at the end, listen to the same song on repeat for several consecutive hours. Uh-huh. Wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning. Don't speak to anyone. Take an hour-long walk without a companion, phone, music, or destination. Have one friend who is roughly twice your age and one friend who's roughly half your age. So when I think of that, I think of the watercolor for a lawyer's story and of Jacques Lecoq. I'm wondering if this sort of experimentation and playfulness and non-writerly influence is part of how you teach.
Yeah, I want it to be. I mean, there's the problem of the workshop. You know, the workshop is a problem. It doesn't, when we go into a workshop setting and we're trying to tell a writer who submitted their story to us or their excerpt or whatever, how to write that story better, I think what happens is that everybody is stating their own aesthetics, and then they're trying to give those aesthetics to this person who they assume needs their help. When I think the problem is when we're beginning writing or when we're in process with a draft of something, the problem is not that you need somebody else's advice or someone else's control over your work. It's that you need to understand what is moving you. And so I try and focus the workshop that I run entirely on helping the person, helping each student individually when their turn comes up to untangle the parts of the story or piece that they're working on and try and figure out what does it say about them as an artist overall, not just in that story, and also help them understand what is their project overall, what are they trying to achieve. And I don't mean like, oh, they want to write a 500-page book that's a New York Times bestseller and like all these, you know, outside things, but what do they want, how do they want the reader to be changed at the end of reading whatever it is that they're trying to produce. So that I try and focus exclusively on that. And then when I do like seminars, yeah, I do like focus more on experiences that a person can be going through rather than telling them this is how you write this kind of character, this is how you write this kind of book, because I don't think I know. I know how to do it the way that I do it, but I don't want a student to come away from a class they've had with me and be writing the kind of book that I would write, you know, or trying, because I think that's a mistake. They can only write the book that they can write, and I can't write that book, and they're the only person that can do it. And so they need to figure out what are the parameters of their project rather than what are the parameters of other people's projects and how can I please other people with the work that I make.
So. Well, what's interesting, so I had the good fortune. So just to give context, this is the end of a week of the Tin House Summer right. Writers Workshop, and that's why you're in Portland. And I had the good fortune of running into someone who was in your workshop. So uh-huh. did a little bit of intelligence gathering.
Uh-huh.
But like I mean, when I think of like the standard workshop model, which I think nowadays I would guess more teachers are find problematic than not. Like if we go yeah. back to like Frank Conroy, mid-century, like the idea that the writer doesn't speak, mm-hmm. they don't even necessarily need to be there. We're talking about the work as right. if we had encountered it like on the sidewalk and we're just going to have a discussion about how it doesn't work and where. And that everyone goes around and gives their comments and then the writer takes them home and figures out what to do.
Right.
And it feels like from what you've just said and also my spy in your workshop, that you've sort of inverted this, that the author becomes the source of the answers mm-hmm. in a way, like they almost get interviewed.
Right.
I just wanted to hear.
Well, it's more like the relationship that you have with an editor, you know, where like my editors, when I've worked with them on a manuscript, they don't they don't come in and say like, oh, Catherine, these are the five things I like about this, and these are the five things that you have problems with. That's not the conversation at all. They engage with me about the ideas that are in the work, which is much more important. I should say also that I'm not the only person that's doing workshops like this. The more people I talk to about it, the more I find that there's less and less people actually just doing the traditional, you know, Iowa, like, mid-century method of workshop. Though there is something, you know, there is something to be said for that method as well. I'm exhausted by it. And to me, it's not useful at this moment. So
before we leave pedagogy, I wasn't able to make your talk, Learning is a Mistake.
Okay.
But I would love to hear a little bit about, you say, what can we learn from the alto saxophone, mime technique, cult deprogramming, and other things that only seem have nothing in common with the writing process. And would just love to hear a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I know, like, somebody tweeted a quote that part of learning to write is stopping yourself from joining the cult of your own writing.
Right. Yeah, the cult of your bad writing, you know, especially. Well, the talk, you know, every time I give a craft talk, I will say, yes, I will do this craft talk. And then some time will pass and I'll have to write the craft talk. And then while I'm writing the craft talk, I tend to disagree with whatever the statement was that I said that I would give a talk about. And so I end up having to kind of rewrite everything. And then often, sometimes even right before I give the talk, I find that, well, I disagree with this again. There's just, it's, to me, like, talking about craft is sort of, it's just a constantly moving target. I feel like I'm shifting my ideas about how to best do this or that, or, you know, depending on what I'm working on at that time, like, my approach might be very, very different. So I tried this time to create a craft talk that I would not disagree with and need to change at the last minute. And so I did this by creating a series of metaphors or things that I found in the world that I think are revealing about many aspects of the creative process and the writing process and writing in general. And so one of them was the musician Colin Stetson. Have you heard of him?
I haven't.
You've heard him because he plays saxophone in like a ton of indie bands, but he's a composer, an incredible musician. And he basically, like, according to, you know, most people who know more about it, like, completely revolutionized the way that we think the saxophone can even be played. He does circular breathing, which is not new, but it's very, very difficult. So he's able to hold notes out for a very long time. But then he also does this kind of like humming, singing thing into the instrument. And he'll wear like a neck microphone. So it's like the reverberations between his neck and the instrument become a part of the piece. And then also he gets this kind of percussive element out of the keys of the saxophone. And it's an extremely physical thing. You can go back and, like, I think there's a video from him around like 2014 or something where he's playing it, and he looks like he's about to die. Like, he just, it's it's so exhausting. It's like he's running a marathon and, like, juggling something and tap dancing all at the same time and, like, giving a dissertation about and singing. You know, it's like it's so many things happening at once. And he, you know, for almost 200 years, the saxophone sounded the exact same, pretty much, depending on the player a little bit and the instrument, I mean the score a little bit, but when he plays saxophone, it sounds like 17 instruments I haven't even heard somehow playing simultaneously, and it's one guy. So when I feel like there's a limit to how much you can do with putting words on a page, I just think about what he's doing, you know, and I think that there's always more to push into. And I wonder if, like, you know, 50 years from now there'll be somebody that's doing everything Colin Stetson is doing and, like, something else, you know, and it's just, you know, there's always more to sort of find in crafts that we think are, we know everything about. We don't know everything about writing,
right?
You know, we don't understand, and I don't mean in the kind of experimental, like, I don't know, nonsense kind of, like, not making sense on purpose sort of writing. But I think even just on a very, like, practical level, there's just, you can be running a variety of feelings through a story and give satisfaction on multiple levels that I think that he has found a way to do. So that was like one of the anecdotes, and I played a piece of his, and then it was like another anecdote, you know, and another anecdote. And then that way it's like, I can't go back in and edit what Colin does, because he just does what he does. So the talk was just a series of these true things that are, I find helpful, you know.
What almost feels like he's making the instrument unfamiliar to himself.
Yes, in exactly.
And all obviously to us by extension.
Yeah, yeah. Precisely.
So I wanted to maybe tie that in, probably in an awkward way, but I'm going to try to tie that into like this idea of bodily enactment and creating different language through the body. So the epigraph of Certain American States is an excerpt of a dialogue from Annie Baker's Circle Mirror Transformation. And I'm just going to paraphrase one of the speakers. She says, "Do you ever wonder how many times your life is going to end? How many times your life is going to totally change and then start over again, where you'll feel like what happened before wasn't real?" And this sort of reminded me a little of the Jacques Lecoq engagement with masks, where he says, there are three masks, the one we think we are, the one we really are, and the one we have in common. Mm-hmm. And both of these together made me think about your attraction to the moments when a person's life ends and begins again. Mm-hmm. So like all of a sudden, one of the people who in this partnership is wanting to do something entirely different. And what's that going to happen? And whether like the teaching techniques that help us loosen our sense of self might be related to this like loosening of a sense of what is a saxophone. So like when you talked about in the creative independent piece, like waking up at 4 a.m, if we were to act our lives in these really basic ways in a different way, where it's unfamiliar to maybe we normally sleep to 9, would we create a different language? Would there be a different sound to what we did if we put these sort of arbitrary, put the neck microphone down there while we play the saxophone?
Right, yeah. I mean, I think living as, you know, safely as you can in sort of a disruptive state is just, it's essential. I don't know. I mean, it's so easy for us to get stuck in our habits of comfort and routine, and I'm a deeply like routined person, and because of that I try and work against it as much as I can, just so I don't stop seeing things. That's why I love travel, because, you know, like I am in Portland now, and so I guess that's travel. So I saw a friend and that has moved here, and then I was walking back, just, you know, through some sort of mundane neighborhood and encountering just different like objects and light and birds, and you know, I wasn't, the impulse sometimes is to like multitask and like, okay, well, let's listen to a podcast at the same time. And I when I don't do that, and especially when I'm traveling, like the world sort of lights up in this vivid way, and you can see this cat that's like, you can see something in that cat that you can't see necessarily from that same cat that you encounter on the walk to work every day, and you don't see the cat anymore. Or like, you know, I came across this person who's like walking down like this alleyway, and she looked at me and she was like holding a jar, and like I think normally I would have like just sort of kept going, you know, but she was like looking at me, and she just said hello, and it was because I was sort of open to talking to her, and then I was like, oh, hi, and then she just told me, she was like, I'm extremely intoxicated, you know. And I was like, I got this kind of, and she was so just happy, and it was a beautiful afternoon, and she was intoxicated and she wanted to tell me, and I thought that was really like, oh wow, I got this like window into this person, and it's because I'm in an unfamiliar place, and it's because I'm in a, you know, a disrupted, the routines that I'm normally in are disrupted by this moment, you know. I think that's something that's, it's just good for, I don't think it's even writing advice, and it's just, I think all good writing advice is actually just good life advice. So
well, that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for being on the
thanks
show today,
for, thanks for having me. I love this, it's great.
We're talking today to Catherine Lacey about her short story collection, Certain American States. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River, 104.3, Philomath, and the Willamette Valley. Stay tuned for the World Beat Connection. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland, presenting Mexican-American singer-songwriter Lila Downs on Monday, October 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org.